Hi, everybody. Welcome. It's been a while, and I hope that I will be able to present something useful and interesting for you. I, since many years, have been, I guess you could say, thinking about, considering, struggling with the idea of ethics and morality. For many, many years, even before, I would say I started worrying about this in the early 80s, I became aware that there was something to be understood and a certain transformation required when one would consider ethics and morality as a fundamental principle. Now, I know that there are many principles that we consider to be fundamental, yet somehow I think these principles of ethics and morality have been overlooked by the community of devotees in a manner which is not productive and which can be harmful. Now, the word ethics is very much connected to and related to the idea and questions regarding correct conduct within a society. And since basically the beginning of human society, religion, doesn't matter in what form, has been one of the, or practically the main guiding force in determining this. I mean, in the our tradition, you have Grandfather Bhishma on the bed of arrows, giving very specific principles of ethics and moralities for a leader and for people in society, to the audience who is listening. If you look at today's situation, we have a real conflict between the differing religions and the ethics, or what is expected as conduct, between them. And that is what's causing an enormous conflict in this world. First of all, when one derives one's concept of ethics from religion, that means one accepts the vision of proper action from that religion that guides how we decide what to do. And each religion sees things differently. That is, the vision behind that particular religion is unique to that religion and by definition different than other religions. Otherwise, why have it? So we are living today in what's called a pluralistic society of religion, meaning that there are many religions, each with their very specific idea, each who have gotten their ideas of ethics and morality from their traditions from many, many years ago. And these principles were derived within specific cultures that were prevalent when the religion was originating. From our point of view, we have a lot of problems sometimes with principles and ideas which are given to us because they come from a time which is antiquated, obsolete, no longer relevant. So what do we do with that today? How we deal with that is part of what's called an ethical dilemma. That we have our ethics as individuals, but we are given a system by our religion. So what do? You know, that's even going on outside of religion. You have the exact same discussions going on in regular society without any religious context as people struggle with what is right, what should be done. We are always analyzing, evaluating, and promoting correct conduct and good character, but according to the standards of the society we live in at the present. Therefore, we are constantly struggling to find out what's the best way to act, how to do what's right, how to do what is best. Now, some people say you just do what's in the Shastra, or you just do what's in the Bible. You don't do anything else. You don't deviate from that. Yet, at the same time, we are constantly challenged by situations which are not defined in the Shastra. Here's a great example, book distribution. As a concept, it sounds good. We want people to read these literatures so that they can develop and advance and become Krishna conscious. But when you go out to practically distribute books and you have to get money for them, you will find that you run into the wall of demand. In other words, they don't want it. So you have to convince them that they want it and they will give you money for it. And here we have an ethical dilemma. One of the most significant aspects of ethics comes when we have a dilemma. What should we do? What is the right thing to do? The value of the religion, doesn't matter if it's a sectarian part of it or a sub part of it or whatever, the value of the religion that we are in is that giving them these books is a good thing to do. Nobody argues with that. It's what's called a given or an axiomatic truth that people getting the Shastra is a good thing. It doesn't matter if Christians think it's a terrible thing, that because they are not part of this vision. But the dilemma arises in us at the point of approaching another person to give them, distribute to them, sell them this book. Now, if you were to tell them exactly what you would expect them to become after reading the book, they would laugh at you and run away. I don't mean a lover of God and ecstatic bliss and all that. I mean all the other stuff that is within the culture, like, you know, regulative principles and chanting and associating with devotees and a pile of stuff which people would say, what? Now, because we are modern men, when I say men, women, it's all of us here. We're modern humans. We are well versed in Machiavelli. The ends justifies the means. By hook or by crook, sell the book. Now, here we understand how ethics specifically is pushed aside because end justifies the means. This is a principle which has ruled Western society for hundreds of years. There were various techniques for selling books in the earlier days where, you know, they would collect money by changing up the people, by not giving them the proper change back. And it was a very nasty technique. Or just telling the people whatever you think they might want to hear so that they'll buy the book. I am justified in doing something which is directly wrong, misrepresenting, fraud in a criminal sense, because the end justifies the means and the end is absolute. This is one of the issues with deriving ethics and morality strictly from religion. I ran into this when I first joined ISKCON. I had a nice car. I mean, it wasn't terribly expensive, but it was a nice car. So I brought it to the temple and thought, sure, devotees can use it. It was registered in my name. And devotees would just park it anywhere illegally, and they got over $2,000 worth of parking tickets. They never serviced it. They smashed it in various ways. They made a mess in the car with lunch all over the place. So I was really seriously upset. So I went to the person who was supposed to be in charge of this. I said, what's going on? He said, it's not your car. It's Krishna's car. And because it's Krishna's car, you don't have any ownership. No one has any ownership. If everything belongs to Krishna, then nobody takes care of it. This was the basic attitude amongst everybody. I had a very hard time with this because in my structure of ethics, when you were given provision of a particular thing, you should take care of the thing because that's what one does. So this is an example of how religion and the values can be used to justify immoral or incorrect actions. Ethics is something we do. It is a task, if you will, of continually understanding what is right, what is good, what is best. And here we come to another very interesting conflict. An individual may think what counts is what is good, right, and best for me, how I feel, how I want, what my desires are. This is pretty similar to a not very developed young baby, young child, that kind of mentality. And then you have the idea of a society that I have to take into consideration what's best for the group. I have to take into consideration what's best for the earth. I have to take into consideration individuals within these groups. So we have an ethical dilemma between the individual and the group. Yet another thing I have been dealing with for the last many years, that when the group dominates over the individual, the group must have very sophisticated and well-developed ethics and morality. Yet, of course, I can continue this discussion in relationship to the broader society, but I'm very much concerned with how it affects devotees in ISKCON and outside of ISKCON, but related, that this ethical dilemma is actually one of the fundamental things that has to be resolved before things are going to get better. Are we educated in ethics and morality? Did we ever discuss it in great detail? I don't think so. Maybe somebody might have brought it up sometime, but I don't think there's been a very detailed analysis and discussion and training in this. I mean, if you look at the four principles of Dharma the Bull, you have austerity, mercy, cleanliness, truthfulness. If you think about those things and you analyze it in a very specific way, you start to understand how, wait a minute, something's missing here. Let's say, for example, mercy and empathy are very much related. To care about how people are, to feel when they are suffering, to desire to do good for someone else. So let's say you are with austerity and mercy, you have still those qualities, and you decide that according to the vision of the religion, you should do austerity. But the person who is saying that is not empathetic, does not understand the consequences of what they are saying. So one of the issues within religion is to not take things as a whole, but rather to focus on certain points and emphasize them. And the reason why somebody would do that is because it's advantageous for them to do that. Usually those who are saying such things are in a managerial position or some kind of leadership position, and they're going to get something out of it managerially or even personally, who knows. So when we're dealing with the ethics of this, that person is not in an ethical dilemma. That person has made a choice. The ethical dilemma falls to those who are in a higher position, if there are any, who look upon this and say, that is wrong. I personally don't like a management principle that is based on catching up, meaning that when something goes wrong, you correct it. I believe I'm more comfortable with a system which prepares for as many incidences as possible so that things go wrong less. For example, one who creates a system of ethics and morality which is a fluid one, meaning that one creates within the mind of the student an atmosphere where one can understand from all of the principles that one is taught how to make a choice. When you have people within the religion who know how to make ethical choices, who know how to determine what is right, the society works much better. You can't just throw somebody into a position and expect them to understand these things. These are not common sense things. These are things which need to be understood in relationship to various examples and real life situations. Although ethics, to a certain extent, has theory, conceptualized theories, but it is most apparent in action. Here's a situation. What do you do? What do you do is very much like a how do I solve? How do I accomplish? How do I get to where I think I should go? But actually, more importantly is why? Why should I do that? Even if I understood what has to happen, but why does that have to happen? These questions are part of the philosophical undertaking of becoming an ethical person. Mostly people inquire about these kind of things when they are actually puzzled about how the principles they are supposed to be embracing apply in a very specific situation. Whenever humans live together, whenever they work together, there'll always be different ideas and always be this conflict, and then the tension has to be resolved. Someone may say this is required because it is the vision It is the mission. Another one may say, this is not required because it does not ultimately fulfill the mission of personal development or proper modes of action. I couldn't possibly give solutions here. I am saying, though, there has to be a methodology, there has to be training, there has to be practical action and experience in making ethical decisions that work. And to have one's own personal, ethical, and moral compass, we call it, meaning a standard, something that points us in the right direction, regardless of what we're going through. I think this is as important a department of knowledge for devotees as learning Bhagavad Gita, because Bhagavad Gita is filled with a discussion of ethics. In fact, Arjuna starts off the Bhagavad Gita by arguing with Krishna about ethics. So I think that there should be a very sophisticated department of ethics which can discuss ethics and morality in practical affairs and situations so that devotees can understand how to make choices. If you don't know how to make choices, then you're going to be batted around like a ping pong ball by whatever the predominating belief system is, whatever you've heard from those around you, or the news, or social media, or your group of friends outside of those around you, or family members. They can give you these ideas, but if you don't know how to make your own personal choice, you're just going to be swimming in all these ideas. And when you're challenged by circumstances, you're not going to be able to navigate that challenge. You're not going to be able to do something which is actually best for yourself and for those around you. It's not going to be possible. Very few situations in this world are exactly parallel to what you might have in the Shastra, for example. So it is essential that we learn the art of making choice properly. And with that, I will leave you with that thought. And I guess we'll take 5 or so minute break. And if you want to ask questions, you can certainly do that. The first question is, isn't ethics and morality something that should come from within rather than be imposed upon us from the outside rules and regulations of a religion? Isn't the main goal of a teacher to teach the students to feel and be empathetic and aware enough to feel and understand the feelings of others and the consequences of their actions? Seems like religion is often an obstacle in ethics because people dive into the rules instead of feeling and analyzing and making feeling-based personal choices. Well, that is a controversial topic, not a clear one. For example, your feelings are not related to ethics. Ethics is not something you alone derive. It is something much more universal. For example, when you feel something that, let's say there's an ethical principle which is very, very important, but you feel it is totally wrong. If it's an actual ethical principle, meaning one that is derived from a very advanced conception of right, of something that is good and right, and you feel it is not, your going with your feeling is not the resolution of an ethical dilemma. It is just simply deviating from the ethical standard. Yet at the same time, I understand the point, because I brought it up myself, that to simply put forward some kind of ethical or moral principle without empathy, for instance, about those who you are putting it forward on or to, is an ethical dilemma, meaning that one might choose not to follow it because it is disregarding empathy. But what if you don't feel empathetic? What if you're not empathetic? Now, empathy is in and of itself part of mercy, which is a basic principle of Dharma, which are ethical, moral principles. So if you're not being empathetic in your feelings and rejecting an ethical principle, that doesn't make it better just because you feel it. So you're absolutely right that the teaching has to synthesize the two, that a student who's learning has to learn the principle of the ethic and at the same time understand the application of it, and to learn the difference between mindlessness and actual conscious application. Now, another very, I would say, interesting thing is that it seems like religion is an obstacle because people dive into the rules. Now, is that a problem of religion, or is that a problem of the application of it? I think if you would seriously analyze religious principles or religious ethics, you would find that the real issues arise in the application, which means the opinion and feeling of the applier, not the religious principle itself. I think, and it may be controversial to say this, and I may not be 100% correct, but I think that ethics is more of a rationale thing, that it requires rationality more than it requires feeling. So ethics and choosing how to act is very much a rational choice. I think that, like I'm saying, this is a very surface presentation of the topic. So I'm not going to get into a lot of detail about all of the ways in which things could be understood differently. But I'll move on to the next question. Okay, the second question is, indeed, ethics and morality are based on the development of certain qualities. That's phrased wrong. I want to address that first part. If the development of certain qualities is referring to an individual who then is basing ethics and morality on their development of their own personal qualities, then I'd say no. If the development of certain qualities are a vision of the society or the religion, then yes, ethics and morality would be based on that, yes. And the question goes on, and indeed, in the organization we once were in, the emphasis was not on the development of qualities, but on adherence to principles, repetition of mantra, and service. At the same time, for example, in Christianity, one of the most important spiritual principles was considered the development of qualities. That is, ethics and morality were based on a simple principle. For example, love your neighbor as yourself. The question is that maybe we should pay attention to this thousand-year experience of trying to develop qualities in other religions, in particular in Christianity, although Christianity itself has committed a huge number of violent acts against believers of other religions. Well, okay, sure. For example, there's the Ten Commandments in Christianity, good ethical principles, the five pillars of Islam, good principles, and the Eightfold Path of Buddhism, good principles, ethical principles. But in Hinduism or in Vaishnavism, there's tons of ethical principles, probably a pile more. It's just a question of extracting them. I know for sure there's nothing in those lists of ethics that is not in Vedic literature somewhere. Yet, and here's a big yet with a big Y, yet, I think, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, is something that ISKCON members definitely should learn. If I wanted to lose my mind, I could come up with thousands of examples why. But it would give me a headache, so I won't. But I mean, that's a very simple ethical principle. And yet, how much training is there in that? Oh my God, you could say so much about that. And number three, in fact, can the principles of morality and ethics develop if a person does not cultivate sattva-guna? Okay. Because in rajaguna and tamaguna, it is very difficult to resist temptations that violate morality and ethics. Whoa, that's really cool. Well, the question is the answer. Because sattva-guna is where rationality is not crushed by desire or crushed by just lethargy. Actual rationality, actual development of the capacity to understand how to deal with choices in an ethical dilemma requires sattva-guna. So the development of sattva-guna requires the letting go of raja and tamas. So yes, many of the principles that exist are there for that reason. So really good point. And hang on. Oops. Oof. Huh. Do you see what Todi wrote, Amashaya? Okay. Wow. Not sure how I'm going to answer it, but I'll read it anyway. Just today, I was speaking with someone about this topic. And if there is really important and about whether if it is really important or proper to spread instructions on the spiritual path in a mass scale. The purpose of this knowledge is to be a tool for self-realization, but any tool can be turned into a weapon if it comes into the wrong hands. As I understand, previously such knowledge was considered secret and was given privately from teacher to disciple. Do you think spread of spiritual knowledge containing very specific instructions in some sense is compromising ethic principles? Well, you know, okay, I understand this question's on multiple levels. That there is the level of Bhagavad Gita, which is open for everybody, so the ethical principles in Bhagavad Gita are not a secret. And so discussing them or teaching them is no problem whatsoever. But when you start talking about secret and master, you're talking about higher principles. You know, maybe those discussed by the Goswamis or Bhaktivinoda Thakur in some of his books. Sure, I would say spreading, if you were to be spreading such knowledge indiscriminately, yes, there's an ethical problem there. It is not right. Neither is it good. That's correct. So I would say when you're on such a level of instruction, such a level of understanding, then naturally, yes, there should be a certain level of discretion on who that is spoken to. Absolutely. But as far as that kind of rasa or that kind of relationship with Radha and Krishna being used as a weapon, I don't really see that. I would see that more in the usage of energy or energetic, attacking people or using it to manipulate people or to control people. Yes, that is a way in which the knowledge can be used as a weapon. So I would say, yes, that should be avoided, because that really definitely would compromise ethical principles. Here's another question from Kamala Mala, which is a statement, and I'll just let it state itself. I assume that at the time of Lord Chaitanya, all his followers had very highly developed morals and ethics, and this was taken for granted. Obviously, Lord Chaitanya would not have associated with people who were not highly moral. And the question is the answer. And number five, I have the impression that in the scriptures, transcendental relationships often become an alternative to piety with its moral principles. As, for example, one can see in the Bhagavad Gita or the 10th canto of the Bhagavatam, Rasa Dance, being a follower of religion and reading these scriptures, a person involuntarily draws parallels between their heroes and himself as if claiming a transcendental level. Maybe this is the reason why religious morality comes into conflict with simple human morality. Let me think about that. Okay, you can read it. But... okay, I get it. That... there are actions in the spiritual sky which, when transformed or when transported into a material concept or a material context, not concept, would be inappropriate and would not be accepted in according to actual present-day religious morality. Yes, absolutely so. Yeah, I mean, that makes perfect sense, and that's correct. And of course, in the mundane sense, you couldn't possibly have a dance which would come anywhere close because there would be no Krishna in the middle of it. I think it's very interesting how the audience here is picking up on the various forms of a dilemma, the dilemmas that could be there. That's very valuable. Especially if later on one wants to develop this. All these points are really good and valuable. I like it. Okay, number six. I once said that society is lacking in goodness and good people. What is the essence of goodness and what does it mean to be a good person? Well, yeah, I mean, like if we're going to talk about ethics and morality, obviously one of the desires is to be a good person. A person who does what's right in as many situations as one can for the benefit of the whole, so that the context of the individual's actions benefits the whole and the individuals within it. If one is living in sattva guna and is living a life within those modes of goodness, one doesn't even necessarily have to be involved in a group of any kind. So what I just said related to group action, but it could also relate to an individual living in the forest who's caring for the forest, who's caring for the nature. I would think that what it means to be a good person is to analyze, to define a good person as somebody who knows what is right and knows how to make the right choice, how to decide what is best. That's a person who's good, A good person is always seeking to do what is right. But then we get into the problem of what is right. How do you define right? I mean, if you're in the mafia, for example, what is right would be to, for example, kill these people over here who are against, you know, the group making money. And that is right. So what is right would be modified according to whatever group you're in, which is determining these values. And if you question that, you've got an ethical dilemma. And a good person, according to my definition, would be somebody who analyzes the situation, understands the actual sattva-gun context of it all, or the context of the shastra, and makes the choice, the right choice, to do the right thing. I mean, actually, don't ask me to start defining things like this is right, this is wrong. This is definitely ethics, the best ethics, and this is definitely the best morality. It is so changeable depending on context. And that's why this is a huge discussion. These discussions of ethics and morality are huge because it is so variable depending on the context. Even amongst very intelligent people, there will be all kinds of discussions to determine this. So the real issue of a good person is somebody who is struggling to do what is right. Number 7, are ethical and moral principles relevant only for people, or are they also important in relationship with animals and even trees and insects? Definitely. Without compassion, can there be morality and ethics? No. Is spirituality possible without compassion? No. Number 9. Will our moral and ethical qualities develop automatically if we develop our contact with the deities? Take out the word automatically. By being in contact with the deity, moral and ethical qualities develop. Exactly how that happens is an ongoing process. Something that requires the interaction of many experiences, many challenges, many dilemmas that need to be resolved. I would call it muscle. And just like, you know, you have to develop muscle by exercise, by even coming in conflict, maybe if you're a boxer or whatever. If you're a sports person, you want to develop muscle, you got to run and leap. And it's kind of like the conflict creates that muscle in the brain, which is why when we get older, these things become clearer. Sati is asking me in number 11, can I make a broadcast to explain how to define the fake, as in sahajya of rasa, for example, from the real? If we hide the experiences, we would not be able to inspire others and the impossible while we are in the body. I would not like to talk about that. It's too complicated and cost-benefit, you know. Everything has cost-benefit, you know, what it costs and what you get out of it. So cost-benefit doesn't balance properly, that discussion. I don't even think it's possible to define the difference between fake and real. I don't think such a definition exists. Yeah, for sure, if I'm talking about a Rolex watch, this is an Apple watch, but that doesn't matter. A Rolex watch and then a fake Rolex watch from China, you know, one costs, I don't know what, $50,000. The other one costs, you know, $10. Obviously, you can talk about fake and real. That's easy. But when you're talking about sharing, because you're talking about sharing your experience of, or even to try to use that as a means to encourage others to understand how to enter into rasa, for example, who's doing the definition? It becomes complicated. Defining is difficult. One has to understand from symptoms. One has to understand from how it affects you. One has to understand from the actual experience and whether or not you can share it. Can you share a false experience? No, because it doesn't exist. Or maybe it does exist and you've defined it in another way. You can share a false conception of an experience, yes. But if you're sharing an actual spiritual experience, you can't fake that. But then one asks, why would one do that? Well, there are probably answers to the question. Yeah. Okay, I quit. And I thank you all very, very much for being here today. And I do hope to see you again. I can't say when, but thank you so much for being here today.